When I was in college, I had this chance to take a trip to East Asia. It was spring break, and our church was connected to a family who worked there, and they were there because they wanted people to know about Jesus. And so me and some of my friends went on this trip to learn from them, to encourage them, and to serve them. I didn't know a single word in their language, but we found ourselves on a college campus where we knew some of the students were studying English. And so I walked out onto a basketball court and I said, "Does anyone know English?" And I met this guy. His name is Jay. The next week, I spent a lot of time with Jay. I was able to share the gospel with Jay. And he and my friends would answer his questions and talk to him. And he was considering, I think for the first time, a Jesus that he had never heard before. But I also was hearing something from him I had never heard before. For the first time in my life, I was speaking with someone who, when they were thinking about coming to know Christ, they had to consider real heavy consequences. Consequences from his family, social consequences, potentially even criminal consequences. But every day he would agree to talk with us again the next day. Day after day, we would hear about the tension in his heart. "I want to follow Jesus. I think I believe what you're saying, but the consequences just might be too great." We were only there for about 10 days, and at the end of the trip, Jay did not become a Christian, but that experience taught me a lot about what it looks like to persevere. That experience changed the way that I pray. It changed the way that I think about my personal spiritual disciplines. It changed the way that I endure. And it made me think about, what if I was Jay? What would I do if my situation was as complex as his? Would I still see Jesus as worthy of my worship despite all of the consequences? Now, our lives that we live here are not a one-to-one parallel with people in other countries, but there are other difficulties that we face that try to take our eyes off of Jesus and to convince us that maybe it's not worth the trouble to follow him. Maybe you or someone you love has just recently received a diagnosis. Maybe you have family members that just don't understand why you are the way that you are, why you believe the things that you believe. Maybe you've lost work friends or relationships because you have a different opinion about faith. Maybe as you sit here this morning, you feel the weight of your kids not believing in Jesus, your spouse not believing in Jesus. Maybe you yourself this morning are full of doubts because of the number of things taking place in our world or in your life. In Revelation chapter 14, John wants to help us endure. He wants to help us to see the certainty of Christ's victory over sin for believers and to encourage us to hold on. And if you're not yet a believer, John wants you to see Jesus for who he is, as someone who's worthy of your praise and worship. If you've been with us so far as we've studied Revelation, 2 weeks ago, we were in chapters 12 and 13, and we learned about the war behind our worship and the war for our worship. We learned about the conflict between the beast and believers, and that this beast uses his power to make himself look appealing to the world and compelling to the world. But we also learned that his end is destructive, that he's weak, he's powerless. I love the way that Pastor Cam described the beast as just a cheap imitation of the one true God. Cheap imitations are never fulfilling in the end. But Revelation 14 this morning is gonna give us a picture of the one true God who's fulfilling, who keeps his promises, who keeps his word, and who one day will restore us and bring an end to all these earthly sufferings that we face. Revelation 14 is divided into three sections. And as we look at each section, we're gonna try to answer just one question for each section. These three questions hopefully will help us to endure suffering in the world as we know that the beast is here in the world as well. These three questions, first, where do we go? Second, who can find rest? And lastly, when will it end? Where do we go? Who can find rest? And when will it end? So let's begin by looking at verse 1 together. And I pray that God will use this to strengthen our faith this morning. First question, where do we go? Revelation chapter 14, starting in verse 1. Then I looked, and behold, on Mount Zion stood the Lamb, and with him 144,000, who had his name and his Father's name written on their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven, like the roar of many waters and like the sound of loud thunder. The voice I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps. And they were singing a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and before the elders. No one could learn the song except the 144,000 who had been redeemed from the earth. It is these who have not defiled themselves with women, for they are virgins. It is these who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been redeemed from mankind as first fruits for God in the Lamb. And in their mouth, no lie was found, for they are blameless. So remember, the end of chapter 13, we've seen this vision of the beast, and now John turns our eyes off of the beast and those who worship the beast in chapter 13 and onto this new vision of a lamb. And we've seen throughout the book of Revelation that this lamb is Jesus. This lamb is the one who has defeated that ancient serpent, who has conquered death and the accuser by his own blood, and who we saw last week on Easter, we saw that he now holds the keys of death and Hades. And now in chapter 14, we see the lamb standing on Mount Zion. Mount Zion is a place throughout the scriptures where God dwelled with his people. The prophets also foretold of Mount Zion being the place where the future people of God would be gathered forever worshiping him. One passage that comes to mind is Psalm 2. Another one that we're gonna look at together is Isaiah 35:10. Just listen to how Isaiah 35:10 describes what will be happening in the heavenly Mount Zion one day. Verse 10, and the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads, and they shall obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. And notice what we just read in Revelation 14. Notice what the Lamb's people are doing on Mount Zion. They're doing exactly what Isaiah 35 said that they would do. They're singing. Verse 2, look at it again. I heard a voice from heaven like the roar of many waters, like the sound of loud thunder. The voice I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps, and they were singing a new song before the throne and before the living creatures and before the elders. And no one could learn that song except the 144,000 who had been redeemed from the earth. So not only is John witnessing this fulfillment of Isaiah 35:10, but he's pointing us to see how God's people react to the battle that's taking place with the beast in the world. They're singing the song of their redemption. And John kind of gives their singing a weird description. It's something that's both like rushing water, something that's like loud thunder, and harp music. I've never heard anything like that. I think that's what John's trying to communicate to us. There are no words. There is no one situation or circumstance that can describe for us the sound that we will hear when we're in that heavenly Mount Zion and we're all around the throne worshiping the one who has redeemed us. John describes both the beauty and the glory, and at the same time, he describes that there's something unsettling. It's like thunder. And why is it unsettling? Let's think about that together. Just a few months ago, I had an experience that will not compare to what John's experiencing, but it's kind of similar. Maybe just give it to me. We'll see. I went camping at Jefferson Memorial Forest. I'd never been camping there before. And when you go camping, typically you're looking forward to falling asleep to the sounds of nature and wind and the crackle of a fire. If you've ever been to Jefferson Memorial Forest, it is right in line with the Louisville Muhammad Ali International Airport. And so I went to sleep to the crackle of fire and these awesome sounds of nature. And I woke up to what I thought was a rocket ship taking off right over my head. It won't be like that, but it'll be something like this, something that's both beautiful yet unsettling. And I think it's unsettling because of what we hear about this song and who can know it. Only the Lamb's people can sing this song. There are some people, those people that John described in chapter 13, who have been deceived by the beast, who have been conquered by the beast, who will, in the end, not be capable of singing the Lamb's song. There are people in your life and in my life, in our families, who we work with, co-workers, friends, neighbors, who will not know the Lamb's song. The song mentioned in chapter 14, verse 3, it is a real song, I do think. I do think we'll be singing a unique heavenly song. We see this in other places in Scripture, but I also think that this song and this singing represents the unique experience of knowing what it's like to be saved by Jesus. Here's why I think this. See how these singing people are described. In the next few verses, they're described as undefiled, redeemed, blameless. Who else can be described like that? Only those of us who have experienced the life-transforming power of salvation in Jesus Christ. Scripture says that we were dead in our trespasses and sin, but that God, who is rich in mercy, showed his love to us through his son Jesus, so that whoever believed in him would not perish but have everlasting life, where we will sing his song as undefiled, redeemed, blameless forever. And this is in part, I think, why Christians are often misunderstood in the world. We're viewed as exiles. We stick out. We live a life that people don't understand. And that's because we've experienced a salvation that has changed us. I was reading earlier this week about this story from the early church in about the first century of the church, after Jesus died on the cross and rose from the dead and ascended into heaven. We have this letter from this official named Pliny. I know we have a lot of babies coming soon. Put that name in the basket for later. But we have this letter where Pliny writes to another, a higher ranking official, asking, "What am I supposed to do about all of these Christians?" Here's how he describes them. He says that they're inflexible. They won't change their mind about Christ. And this, listen to how he describes what they're guilty of. He says, "These Christians have declared that the sum of their guilt has amounted to this, that on an appointed day, they've been accustomed to meet together before daybreak, to recite a hymn to Christ as to a God, and to bind themselves by an oath. Not an oath that they would commit any crimes, but an oath that they would abstain from crimes or any breach of faith." And he's writing this letter to a high-ranking official to figure out, what am I supposed to do about these joyful, gathering, singing, innocent people? Friends, the reality of Revelation chapter 12 and 13 has showed us that we will not just simply be misunderstood in this life, but many of those of us who trust in Jesus Christ will suffer for our faith. But Revelation chapter 14 encourages us to continue singing even when we suffer. But how do we sing? in the midst of our suffering? How can we remain steadfast and enduring? Where do we go? That's the question we wanted to answer. Look with me at verse 4. Revelation 14, verse 4. This is perhaps my favorite way that these believers are described. It is these who have not been defiled or have not defiled themselves with women, for they are virgins. And listen here, it is these who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. That's what it looks like to be counted amongst those who resist the beast in this world. This is what it looks like when we've experienced the goodness and the glory of salvation in Jesus Christ. This is what Peter says in the Gospels. Where else shall we go? If someone ever asks you what it means to be a Christian, this is a great thing that you could tell them. Being a Christian means that I follow the Lamb wherever he goes. This is the pattern of God's people against the facade of the world's power. This is what it looks like to endure, to keep your head down, keep focused on the Lamb and where he's going. You may have a friend in your life who their life is kind of marked by this, and you notice something unique in them. They're just always up to the work of God. I had a friend in college whose name is Chase, and I don't think a single time since college I've seen Chase, and he's not tried to get me to share the gospel with him, with someone that we're around. I do photography sometimes, and I took pictures for Chase's engagement, and I'm hiding in the bushes waiting for Chase and his fiance, or his soon-to-be fiance, to come to the spot that we had picked so that I can take these pictures of his proposal. And right after we get done, we're gonna go to this engagement party, and he points like way across the park and he says, "Trevor, I bet that guy needs to know who Jesus is." Chase is a guy who is committed to each day having his schedule ruined for the sake of the gospel. All of us are committed to some things. Some of us are committed to many things, and that's not bad. I think a lot of the time, the question that we ask when we think about what to give our time to is something like, how can I use what I'm doing and bring the Lamb with me? There's nothing wrong with that. It's a great thing to think. But sometimes we also need to have the courage to say, I'm not doing anything or going anywhere that the Lamb is not leading. I'm looking for him to guide me and to lead me. Kids, you guys are actually pretty good at this because you constantly have people in your life telling you what to do and what not to do. You know the rules. You know where to go, where not to go. Adults, how are we deciding what gets our devotion? Who's telling us what to do? A question to consider at lunch, maybe with your families this afternoon, where is some place that we could invest that Jesus is clearly at work? I think about this in Matthew chapter 16, verses 24 through 26. Matthew chapter 16, verses 24 through 26, Jesus told his disciples what it means for them to want to continue having a relationship with him and to follow him wherever he goes. Jesus says, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. And for what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul?" Sometimes following Jesus is costly, but we have to decide, are the consequences worthy? Is Jesus worthy of the consequences? The answer is emphatically yes. There's a lot of things going on in this first section. I think one mark that we can all carry from this together is that we want to be a people and a church that goes together wherever the Lamb is going. That's what the singing saved multitude from every people and nation in the beginning of chapter 14 did. That's how their lives were marked. And wouldn't it be great if one day that could be said of us, that we were a people who went wherever the Lamb went. This next section, we find ourselves hearing from three angels, and these three angels have one message. It's the greatest message ever told. And John tells us that it's for our endurance. It's a message about rest. And we can imagine that after figuring out where we're supposed to go to endure suffering, we also want to figure out who can find rest or where could we rest. That's the next question that we're gonna think about together. Who can find rest? So read with me the first part of this message, which comes from the first angel, verse 6. Then I saw another angel flying directly overhead with an eternal gospel to proclaim to those who dwell on the earth, to every nation and tribe and language and people. A few things we should note. The angel has just said something that should stop us in our tracks. He has good news for all people everywhere. Can you imagine if we could get everyone everywhere to agree that one thing was good news? Well, he doesn't say that I have news that everyone will accept. He doesn't say I even have news that everyone will tolerate. That's not the case then. It's not the case now. It won't be the case in the end. But this news that the angel brings is good news for all people who will listen. If you remember, we learned about this in Revelation 1 when we started this series. Blessed are those who hear and who do the words of this book, who hear and obey. So look at verse 7. He said with a loud voice, "Fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him who made heaven and earth, the sea and the springs of water." Well, the angel just announced that the God of the universe is coming to judge the earth. At first glance, this again still does not sound like the best news. Before you conclude that this God of judgment or that this angel's message is not worth listening to, I want us to just try a little thought experiment together. Imagine it's 2018 and someone tells you with some amount of certainty that in 2020 there would be a worldwide pandemic, would shut everything down. Just a couple questions to consider. What would you have done differently? What if you knew that was coming? What if you could have prepared? Well, brothers and sisters, the message that this angel brings is good news for you and for me this morning, because we still have time. We can still listen to him. We don't know how much time we have, but we have time to prepare. And if we want to prepare well, we have to listen to what he says. Look at verses 8 through 11 and see what these next two angels say. Remember, it's one message, one gospel, three angels. Verse 8. Another angel, a second, followed saying, "Fallen. Fallen is Babylon the Great, she who made all nations drink the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality." And another angel, a third, followed them, saying with a loud voice, "If anyone worships the beast and its image and receives a mark on his forehead or on his hand, he also will drink the wine of God's wrath, poured full strength into the cup of his anger. And he will be tormented with fire and sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever. And they have no rest, day or night, these worshipers of the beast and its image, and whoever receives the mark of its name." A lot going on here, but the second angel describes Babylon, this city throughout the scriptures, the city of temptation and wickedness, as fallen. Not falling, but fallen. And this is good news that Babylon, this wicked city, is finished. But what's not good news that we see from the angels is that Babylon is taking people with her. The third angel tells us, everyone who follows in the way of Babylon, who takes its mark, like we read at the end of chapter 13 2 weeks ago, who drank the wine of Babylon, will drink the wine of God's wrath. Those who do not submit to the Lamb, who do not follow him wherever he goes, who do not sing his song, they will be in God's presence, but they will not be found singing, it says. Verse 10, they will also drink the wine of God's wrath, poured full strength into the cup of his anger. And they will be tormented with fire and sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. The smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever. They have no rest. This is good news because while the beast wages war against us in this life, we have a promise that the beast and his servants who try to work against us aren't just working against us. They're working against the Lamb. They're working against the God of the whole world, and he died for you, and he won't let you suffer forever. But the beast and those who worship the beast, they will never rest because of what they've done. And none of us say that from a place of pride because we were just like them. But then we heard this invitation from Matthew chapter 11, verses 28 through 30. Hear these words from Jesus. Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. This message is good news because you and I have time to hear and listen to the message of the Lamb, to see Jesus for who he is and who he says he is, to rest in him. This message is good news because of what we see in verses 12 and 13. Look there with me. Here is a call for the endurance of the saints, those who keep the commandments of God and keep their faith in Jesus. Verse 13, I heard a voice from heaven saying, write this, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Blessed indeed, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds follow them. If we die in the Lord, which I think also implies that we've lived for the Lord, following him wherever he goes, we will rest with him forever. And we get this promise that now Jesus is in heaven preparing a place for you and for me. And even though we know we have rest, we know we can come to God in the midst of all of this. Maybe you find yourself still asking, when will it end? I know I have rest. I know God keeps his promises. I know I need to just keep plodding and keep doing what I have committed myself to doing and asking God's Spirit to help me and help me hold on. But when will it end? That's the third question that we see answered in this third section. Some of you have been asking this question for a very long time because of your suffering. I found myself even feeling the weight of this question at times. And I don't want to say this and make it seem like I've tricked you by asking this sort of question, but we don't know. People often ask this question when thinking about Revelation. When is it? When does the timeline end? And I think chapter 14 gives us a hint that there's not a timeline it can give us, but there is something even greater. Before we look at it, let's look at 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verses 1 through 3. See what Paul says about this question. Verse 1, now concerning the times and the seasons, brothers, you have no need to have anything written to you. For you yourselves are fully aware that the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night. while people are saying there's peace and security, then sudden destruction will come upon them as labor pains come upon a pregnant woman, and they will not escape. Paul not only says that we don't know, but he says that this church that he's writing to has no need to have anything written to them about it. And even though sometimes questions like this come up in our mind and thinking about them can sometimes scratch like a theological itch that we might be having, John tells us exactly what we need to know to endure in Revelation. And it does not tell us a time, but he does say it is coming. It is certainly coming. And the certainty of this reality is meant to create a sense of safety and security for those of us who have trusted in the Lamb. But it's also meant to create a sense of urgency in us. There's people around us who don't know Jesus. There's people around us who, if without anyone going to tell them about Jesus, they will never rest. And they need to rest. He describes this scene for us here in verses 14 through 20 of Revelation 14 of a harvest. It's two harvests, really. The harvest of the righteous and the harvest of the wicked. Let's look at the harvest of the righteous that comes in verses 14 through 16. We just heard from these three angels. Now we look, verse 14. I looked and behold, a white cloud, and seated on the cloud, one like a son of man with a golden crown on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. And another angel came out of the temple, calling with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud, put in your sickle and reap, for the hour to reap has come and the harvest of the earth is fully ripe. So he who sat on the cloud swung his sickle across the earth. The earth was reaped. The image of a son of man sitting on the clouds, I think, is supposed to call our minds back to Daniel chapter 7, where we see the son of man amongst the clouds of heaven. And he's being served there by a people from every nation and tribe and language. And he is said to have an everlasting kingdom that will not pass away. And in Revelation chapter 14, he's holding this sickle. He's ready to harvest. And John here is forcing the issue of our future judgment on us. This future judgment where we will finally and fully see that our actions in this life have real and lasting consequences. Some questions for us to consider as we think about this first harvest. What is the fruit of our life producing? Jesus wants us to think about this. He tells us in John 15, I am the vine. My Father is the vine dresser. Each branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away. And every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes that it may bear more fruit. Abide in me and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit by itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. Whoever abides in me and I in him, he it is that bears much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing. Those who want to be counted amongst the singing and the following and the resting must be sure to be found amongst those who are now abiding in Christ. Living near to him and under his authority, living for his fruit and not for our own. Because like a thief in the night, he's coming. And our lives will be brought into the light for all to see. Come to Christ. John 6 further says, if anyone does not abide in me, he is thrown away like a branch and withers, and the branches are gathered, thrown into the fire and burned. And this is the vision we get in the second part of this final section of Revelation chapter 14 in verses 17 through 20. This angel harvests the grapes of the earth and places them into the winepress of the wrath of God. And I think that these grapes are supposed to represent those people that we read about in chapter 10, or in verse 10, sorry, of Revelation 14 who were described as drinking the wine of Babylon and earning the wine of God's wrath. They're now described as grapes ready for harvest, being placed into the winepress of God's wrath. John here wants to help us endure by reminding us that though we may not know the precise moment when all of this will end, it is not fiction. It is certain it will end. And each of us have this window of time, and none of us know how long it will last. One picture that Jesus uses when he talks to his disciples about the end is about the story of Noah, who was told that one day the whole earth was gonna be flooded. And he was charged with building this ark. And despite constant ridicule and rejection, Noah faithfully plotted and built the ark. And at a time when the earth was ripe, there was a flood. Noah, by faith, was certain that God would keep his word and his promise, just as he said. And we need to ask ourselves, do we have the kind of faith that will give us spiritual grip strength in these moments where our sufferings are too heavy to handle? If you haven't thought much about this, don't let another day pass before you make up your mind. When I left East Asia, my friend Jay did not come to profess in Jesus. But a few years later, I got this text message from him. I had not heard from him since. He told me that he had found some books written by C.S. Lewis in his language and that he had become a believer. Not only that, but he asked me and my friends who were with him on this trip if we would pray for him. That week, his pastor was arrested during church one morning. They weren't sure what they were going to do, but Jay did not simply decide to trust in God as long as things went well for him. Jay decided that the sufferings of this world, the temptation and the deception of the beast, were nothing, just mere specks when compared to the glories that were coming. My prayer for each of us is that we would remember the words of Revelation chapter 14, that we would follow the Lamb wherever he goes, that we would look for him and long for him as we wait for our eternal home. Would you pray with me?